Hi, everyone. It's that time again to talk the talk on conversations on a tightrope. I'm Atrevita, and I want to digress a bit before I share tonight's interview by Jonathan Miller of the BBC in 2004 with the philosopher and scientist Daniel Dennett. I found a CNN news report on the spanking death of a 7-year-old child in the name of God that I want to play since I believe it is relative to these conversations on atheism. Last week, Colin McGinn said he was not only an atheist but also an anti-theist because he feels it is a bad thing to believe in God. This is an example of why he would feel that way. Although not all believers are like this, there are unfortunately many. But these actions cause reactions, and I will play a clip from a young man who was outraged, and you can hear the anger and frustration in his rant. He also reminds me of someone many years ago who was very close to me, and I can relate to what he is feeling. So let me play these clips now.
Parents who beat their child to death in the name of God. They believe the Bible requires them to spank their kids with items like belts and rods in order to parents appear to have been following the teachings of a Christian parenting book called To Train Up a Child, the book that is growing in popularity around the world.
The small town of Paradise, California, where these children lived with their parents in a fundamentalist Christian home, survivors of a violent form of discipline practiced by their parents, Kevin and Elizabeth Schatz, is their 7-year-old adopted daughter, Lydia. She was killed by her parents. They pleaded guilty to killing Lydia and seriously injuring her 11-year-old sister, Zariah, who almost died. Authorities say Kevin and Elizabeth Schatz beat their children regularly because they believe God wanted them to. The district attorney says the Schatz believed
to spare the rod will spoil the child, and if you can train your horse and you can train your dog, you can train your children.
But authorities say this was torture and murder by parents who were supposed to love and cherish their child. Inside this house, they found important evidence. What they were 15-inch-long plumbing supply tubes used to beat the children.
The book is called To Train Up a Child, Michael Pearl, and his wife, Debbie.
They consider themselves observant Christian, who run an organization called No Greater Joy Ministries from their Tennessee farm.
Well, I'm a preacher, minister of the gospel.
Their book and others they've written stacked in a warehouse on their farm, all of them guided, they say, by the teachings in the Bible. In the book, they describe a rod as a magic wand. The Pearls say parents should stay in control and not act in extreme. But they also declare any spanking to effectively reinforce instruction must cause pain.
Let's say a 7-year-old slugs his sister.
A 7-year-old would get 10 or 15 licks, and it would be a formal thing. In other words, you maintain your patient air, you explain to him that what he's done is violent, and that's not acceptable in society, and it's not acceptable in our home. Then I would take him somewhere, like into his bedroom, and I would tell him I'm going to give him 15 licks.
With what?
Probably a belt. A kid that big, a boy, I'd probably use a belt. It'd be handy. I might use a wooden spoon or a piece of plumbing supply line, a quarter inch in diameter, flexible.
Lydia was so severely beaten, she died of a condition usually associated with earthquakes and bombings. Lydia was beaten for 7 continuous hours, interrupted by short prayer breaks on the day she died. Sentencing hearing, 11-year-old Zariah, who had the courage to address her parents in open court about her deceased sister. She said, "Why did you adopt her? To kill her?" Kevin and will be in jail for at least 22 years, and Elizabeth for at least 12.
Do you think if the Schatzes did not read the Pearl's book, there'd be a good chance that Lydia's still alive?
I would think that there would be.
I just finished watching a video titled "Girl Spanked to Death in the Name of God." In this video, these two parents who have adopted, I believe it was 6 to 7 children, beat their child to death by saying that beating your child is acceptable in the Bible. And what you did was wrong, but I love you, but I'm going to show you that I love you, and this is the best way to discipline you is by hitting you. Is by hitting you and putting red marks on your butt, or killing you. No, 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 and no. Many Christians think that it's perfectly acceptable to beat your children, whether that causes bruises or whatever on their body. Which is funny, because aren't you just reinforcing saying, I disapprove of you doing this, but I'm going to physically act violent towards you, hurt them, physically abuse them, like in this instance where these two parents beat their daughter for 7 hours with their little prayer session. Can you believe that? They spanked their child for 7 freaking hours. Hours with little prayer breaks. Prayer breaks. That is so disturbing. Not only that, it is religious bigot, religious freaks, religious... I want to call them... It's religious people like this who use religion, and this is my problem with religion. You use religion to justify whatever the hell you want. I made a video last week about a Mormon who was using his Mormon, the Book of Mormon and Mormon history to justify molesting and having sex with young 12-year-old girls. No. He got on trial, and he justified molesting and having sex with 12-year-old girls, saying that it was his call from God. His call from God. You know, a lot of people seem to use God as a justification for everything. You know what? I might as well stop this video and go out and go murder 5 or 6 people because God is... I feel that God is telling me to go do that, and I'm going to justify it. God said it, I'm going to do it. A child needs discipline. And I don't believe that discipline is through physically hitting them or abusing them. Because aren't you just reinforcing violence? So yeah, that's my... Maybe if you're a Christian, maybe you never thought of it that way. But I'm a criminal justice major, okay? People like this deserve to rot in the depths of hell. Beating your child for 7 hours and then using... Yeah. No. Just no. Sickens me. Viles. They're like physically abused. They're physically abused. They're young adopted black daughter to death. This is the type of stuff that disgusts me. This is the type of stuff where I am against religion. I got so much stuff running in my head, just it angers me at the story I just watched.
When people experience injustice, inequality, and oppression, the words to songs such as the 1960s Carole King's Smack Water Jack represent what can result. On both sides of the spectrum, extreme believers and non-believers. So let's listen.
But you know they hang no smack right then, instead of later. You know the people were quite pleased, 'cause the outlaw had been seized. And on the whole, it was a very good year for the undertaker. You know, you can't talk to a man with a shotgun in his hand. A shotgun in his hand. Smack what a jack for a shotgun. Yeah, smack what a jack for a shotgun. I'll smack what a jack, yeah.
Smack what a jack, yeah.
Talking about a smack what a jack, yeah.
Now, let's get on to the Daniel Dennett interview. But first, who is Daniel Dennett? On Wikipedia, it says that Daniel Clement Dennett was born March 28, 1942. He is a firm atheist and secularist, a member of the Secular Coalition for America Advisory Board, as well as an outspoken supporter of the Brights Movement, a naturalistic worldview which is free of supernatural and mystical elements. Dennett is referred to as one of the four horsemen of New Atheism, along with Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and Christopher Hitchens. Also, according to TED.com, Dan Dennett argues that human consciousness and free will are the result of physical processes and are not what we traditionally think they are. His 2003 book, Freedom Evolves, explores the way our brains have evolved to give us, and only us, the kind of freedom that matters, while 2006's Breaking the Spell examines religious belief through the lens of biology. It also says why you should listen to him. Dan Dennett is our best current philosopher. He is the next Bertrand Russell. And for those of you who do not know who that is, that's he was from 1872 to 1970, a British philosopher, a logician, mathematician, historian, and social critic. It also says that Dennett, unlike traditional philosophers, Dan is a student of neuroscience, linguistics, artificial intelligence, computer science, and psychology. He's redefining and reforming the role of the philosopher, and that's according to a Marvin Minsky. One of our most important living philosophers, Dan Dennett, is best known for his provocative and controversial arguments that human consciousness and free will are the result of physical processes in the brain. He argues that the brain's computational circuitry fools us into thinking we know more than we do, and that what we call consciousness isn't. This mind-shifting perspective on the mind itself has distinguished Dennett's career as a philosopher and cognitive scientist. And the philosophy community has never quite known what to make of Dennett. He defies easy categorization and refuses to affiliate himself with accepted schools of thought. Harry Bloom wrote in the Atlantic Monthly in 1998, to the question of whether machines can attain high-order intelligence, Dennett makes this provocative answer. The best reason for believing that robots might someday become conscious is that we human beings are conscious, and we are a sort of robot ourselves. So, let me now begin these interviews by Jonathan Miller with Daniel Dennett.
In the summer of 2003, I began filming the series Atheism, A Rough History of Disbelief. As part of the process, I talked to a number of writers, scientists, historians, and philosophers. I've always enjoyed my private conversations with the American philosopher Daniel Dennett, and I knew the importance he attached to Darwin's theory of evolution in the development of disbelief. So I asked him why he'd called his book Darwin's Dangerous Idea. And one of the points he made was simply that the theory of evolution was easy to understand, and that's what made it so dangerously subversive.
Unlike some other great scientific advances, going back to Newton or certainly Einstein or best case, perhaps quantum theory, unlike these bizarre revolutions, I think that Darwin's theory is really quite easy to understand. You don't need any math. The basic idea is so simple that you have variation, that inevitably, if there's variation in the population, some are going to be better than others, and the ones that are better than others are going to have more kids than the ones, than the less favored ones, and the offspring are going to resemble their parents. That gives you this little ratchet. And indeed, the idea that you could do that much lifting with a simple ratchet is a stunner. And most of the skepticism has been along the lines of, well, there's just too much work to be done by such a simple process. But time and again, it's been shown, no, there's enough time. The process is more powerful than you might think.
But you can understand why it was that at the beginning, these minute ratchets, minute teeth on the ratchet, would have been seen as implausible contributions to something which was an adaptation. What I'm interested in is, why do you think it was that Darwin's idea was seen as so dangerous rather than simply nonsensical? For the first 50 years, there wasn't enough information to make Darwin's idea anything other than implausible and irreverent. Why was it seen as so dangerous at that time?
Well, in spite of Darwin's best efforts, the implications were there for anybody to draw, and that is, he's not just talking about birds and bees and flowers, he's talking about us. He's talking about our minds. He's talking about our conscience, our soul. Everything, if Darwin is right, is made up of little ratchets doing their little ratchety thing, and it's all just mechanical and blind and purposeless at the bottom. And this was the great inversion, because until then, the idea that there was something like a life force, élan vital, or that there was something like a soul that was completely distinct from matter, and that it somehow informed and controlled and guided creative processes, thinking processes, moral reasoning, and so forth. This top-down idea about morality and self and soul was very plausible until Darwin. And after Darwin, people could see that maybe the soul could be replaced with some of those ratchets. And that's a very threatening idea.
Let me stop right here. Dennett is talking about soul. He says Darwin says it's mechanical, versus the believer's belief that it's an immaterial soul. And now we're going to be hearing Miller talk about disbelief and asking if it took off because of Darwin's mind, soul versus brain, and why Descartes preserved the immaterial soul, how he did that. And Dennett says soul is mechanical and still is the seed of reason, moral responsibility. Gives an example of the loss of a loved one in support of believing in immaterial soul. Before you listen to the rest, there are certain names that he refers to. One is Alfred Russel Wallace, and this was a British biologist who worked on evolution with Darwin. He also mentions a William Paley, who was 1743 to 1805. He wrote Moral Philosophy, Natural Theology, Evidences of Christianity. He had been trained for the Anglican priesthood, and he coined the metaphor, the watchmaker. The other reference is Cartesian, which relates to René Descartes, the philosopher's I Think, Therefore I Am, and his ideas. So let's continue.
So if
Darwin had not produced this dangerous idea, do you think that the development of infidelity, atheism, or disbelief, or however one wants to call it, would have been delayed?
I suppose that's a historical question that one should do very careful research on, and I haven't. But it seems very plausible to me that it was Darwin that broke the dam. Because before Darwin, there really wasn't a good answer to the question, how did this come to be? How did this bird with this wonderful wing, how did it come into existence? If not by some divine act of creation. The rhetorical question, what else could it be, had no answer. That was what William Paley had said. And I think it's important to realize that Paley's argument from design is actually very, very powerful. It challenges any thinker to come up with an alternative. And Darwin called his bluff. He didn't deny the Paley argument. He said, I'm going to meet it head on. Yes, there's fantastic design in the biosphere, and I'm going to show you how you can get that design without a designer.
However, even if Darwin had succeeded in demonstrating how you can get the illusion of design without having to postulate the existence of a designer, it's still hard to resolve the problem of the relationship between minds and brains, so that philosophers, like Descartes, for example, had long ago insisted that the brain and mind were entirely separate. And even now, there's a persistent belief that the mind, the soul, or whatever you want to call it, has an immaterial existence. Well, Daniel Dennett has written eloquently about the problem of consciousness. So I asked him about Darwin's attitude to this problem. Why was it that that Descartes was able to preserve the immaterial soul, and Darwin somehow felt, albeit a Christian, that he did not feel it possible to preserve a comparable sanctuary?
That's a good question, and especially because Wallace was able to make precisely the Cartesian move. Wallace, the co-discoverer of natural selection, said that it covered everything up to the human soul. And he drew the line exactly where Descartes drew the line. Wallace said, no, we have to make an exception for the human mind. And Darwin famously wrote him a letter saying, I think you will kill our child. To Darwin, it was clear that the Cartesian stop, the Maginot line, was indefensible, simply because it was clear that we're primates, we're mammals. The continuity of nature was not going to permit one species on the planet to have miracle stuff in its brain when no other species did. I was once interviewed in Italy, and the headline of the interview the next day was wonderful. I've saved this for my collection. It was, Sì, abbiamo un'anima, ma è fatta di tanti piccoli robot. Yes, we have a soul, but it's made of lots of tiny robots. And I thought, exactly right. Yes, we have a soul, but it's mechanical. But it's still a soul. It still does the work that the soul was supposed to do. It is the seat of reason. It is the seat of moral responsibility. It's why we are appropriate objects of punishment when we do evil things, why we deserve the praise when we do good things. It's just not a mysterious lump of wonder stuff.
Which will outlive us.
Which will outlive us, yes. We do have to give that up. And I'm sure that that's a big part of the inexhaustible appeal of the idea of a soul. All you have to confront is the task of consoling a child whose parent has died, and the natural appeal of the idea of a soul that goes on living is just undeniable. It takes a strong person indeed to not to avail himself of that crutch when responding to a child who's just facing the loss of a loved one.
Or indeed an adult facing the loss of a loved adult as well.
Sure, I mean, sure.
The loss of anyone. So that,
sure.
Really we're saying that the notion of an immaterial soul, by definition, because it's immaterial, is that it's also indestructible.
I think the source of the idea of the immaterial soul that lives on after death is probably largely connected with the fact that the purpose of our living souls, the purpose of our brains, is to project into the future. It's to foresee the future and to have plans and hopes about the future. And those projects and plans and anticipations make us who we are. And we share them. And so we know that the anticipated trajectories of people, and we have our own anticipations for their trajectories. We have hopes for our children and fears for our friends when they go off and do dangerous things. And it's this forward-looking, future-producing activity of the nervous system which we can't just turn off. And when somebody dies, all of those projects are suddenly put into abeyance. It's hard to turn them off. And so the most natural thing in the world to go on thinking about them, and thinking about, well, if Sam were still here, he'd be saying this and we'd be doing this. And it's a short step from there to say, well, you know, he is still here. Well, not here, but here.
But I find it very hard to see how they can actually formulate or conceive the notion of an immaterial continuity of an unembodied self, of how it would know that it was, in fact, the thing that had once been the embodied person with a particular name, with particular projects. It always seems to me that the project, the notion of projects and trajectories and hopes and plans and so forth are all tied up with being embodied.
Oh, yes, and I think that everybody cheats when they think about this. I mean, in the way that scientists cheat, too, when they imagine hard-to-imagine things. So people, when they imagine an immaterial soul, they don't. They imagine a sort of ghosty, sort of semi-transparent material object that's got arms and legs and a particular physical location, but just isn't, you know, quite physical. It's sort of like a hologram, and they know that that's not right. They know that, well, you know, a soul isn't really like that, and they know they can't really imagine an immaterial, disembodied soul. But that's all right. You know, these things are hard to imagine, and you know, physicists can't imagine quantum mechanics, and we can't imagine an immaterial soul. But you know, we can try, and it doesn't hurt to think about, you know, people playing harps sitting on clouds. No, I often ask my students when they were children and reading comic books or they were watching on television, did it ever bother them that Casper the Friendly Ghost could both fly through a wall and catch a ball? I said, why doesn't the ball just go right through his hand? And almost all of them say, oh yes, they had noticed this mildly discomforting inconsistency, but everybody goes along with the gag. But everybody notices that this is not really consistent.
Mm. All right, then. Given the fact that both you and I subscribe to a radical, unreformed Darwinism, how do we live with the notion of the mechanization of our own picture, the radical mechanization of our own picture? What does it leave us with as persons if, in fact, we turn out to be these products of ratcheting?
Well, I think it leaves us almost exactly where we've always been. We get a clearer view of the actual machinery of our souls, if you like, but what we thought our souls were for, what they were good for loving and for deciding, for making and breaking promises for reasons good and bad, that goes on. And we're just a little bit less disillusioned, a little bit disillusioned, I should say, about the nature of that process. But our moral quandaries are what they were before. Our moral aspirations are what they were before. Our capacity to love or to hate are intact. When I speak about Darwinism as universal acid, it passes through, it changes everything, and it leaves everything the same, too.
Now, the last part of these tapes will tell about that he was raised in New England, a Protestant, and offer answers to questions as why are we so polite about religious beliefs but not political, the fact that Dennett expresses the fact that it's hard to be rude when there are beautiful churches, art and music, but maybe we should be rude and try to move the barrier from the center. Maybe we need outspoken liberals. And he goes on to quote, use an expression, the veneer of civilization, and that religion is like a moral Viagra, and should there be something better than religion, and what? So let's just finish this up.
Finally, and this issue cropped up in many of my conversations, I wanted to know how difficult Daniel found it to publicize his disbelief in modern America. But I started by asking him whether there had ever been a time when he himself had had religious beliefs.
Now, here you are, from everything you've said and from everything you've written, I suspect that you and I would, in fact, be called by other people atheists. Was there a point at which you became one? Had you always been one? Or was there is there, in fact, a history of the development of disbelief on your part?
I was raised in one of those bland New England suburban Protestant faiths, the congregational faith, which has hardly any creed at all, but lots of good hymns and ceremonies. And I went to Sunday school and learned the books of the Bible in order, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, etc. So I got a good deal of biblical lore, but not a stern religious upbringing by any stretch of the imagination. And I was always interested in it, intellectually, philosophically. I was, a little budding philosopher. I suppose that I was a teenager before I began to realize that my interest in this was, I feel like, academic. I didn't believe it at all. And I didn't seriously think about whether I'd ever believed it. Or whether it had been just part of a tradition that it was, go along with it, because it's a bit offensive to challenge something like this. I mean, if you see a terribly obese person, you don't walk up and say, "My God, you're obese." We don't do things like that. It's just impolite. Mm. And if people around you are being devout, it's worse than rude to challenge them. And so I don't think I ever really had a conversion experience. I just gradually realized that I didn't believe any of this. I don't think I encountered many people in my youth who really believed in God. I think most people who say they believe in God, most people in the West who say they believe in God, actually believe in belief in God. I don't even believe in belief in God. That is, they believe that belief in God is a really good thing. It is something to strive for, something to be maybe proud of if you succeed. Certainly you should try to believe in God, and you certainly shouldn't make it hard for others to believe in God. And the behavior of somebody who believes in belief in God is just the behavior we observe. You go to church, you sing hymns, you give money to the church, and so forth. If you actually believed in God, you do all sorts of lunatic things, and we have very many people doing those things. They don't put their lives on the line for God, typically. And I thought it was a little bit like belief in Santa Claus. It's something that we do. We talk about it. We sort of pretend to believe in God, and maybe the immature ones actually believe in God. And then some people grow out of it.
Why is it that we have such compunctions about people's faith and devoutness, whereas we're perfectly willing to be rude and argumentative and difficult with people's political beliefs? What is it about the belief in the sacred which is sacred?
I don't know, and I've been wondering that a good deal, because there are times when I think it would be much better if we were a lot franker and ruder about religious belief. If we look around the world today, I would say that by far more danger, more harm comes from religious belief on every side than help. Yes, religions, at their best, provide succor and meaning and comfort to people who are really hard-pressed. And I think that's what we don't want to deny to people.
Yes, I mean, I don't. But nevertheless, I'm often rebuked for being bloody rude about people's religious beliefs. I have very few compunctions about getting into arguments, often in public places, about religion. And I will then go away, and my wife says, you really mustn't talk like that to things that people hold sacred.
Yeah.
And yet, she would be much less embarrassed if I was to have a stand-up row about Soviet communism and about the atrocities committed by Stalin.
I myself do not think that truth is sufficient justification for saying something. And I think we all know that. We don't tell fat people they're fat. We don't tell ugly people they're ugly. We don't. There's lots of things every day we could go around saying things to people's faces that would be perfectly true, and we could prove them, and it would just be really mischievous. There's things about me that I'm glad I don't know, and I hope other people don't know. I certainly wouldn't want people going around spreading this around, and things about you. There's lots of facts that we're just as well off not knowing. That being so, any area of inquiry, especially something like philosophy, which gets so close to things that matter so much to people, I think we have to think seriously about what the environmental impact of putting a view out there is. It's possible that some real mischief, some real harm might come from presenting a position which is in itself perfectly true. But let's look at the boundaries of this. If somebody's a member of a cult, as we say, we have no trouble being rude with them, laughing at the Raelians or those people that got interested in the comet, various doomsday prophesiers when the prophecies don't come true. We laugh at those people, and the world laughs with us at them. So we have a line where we consider some religious belief to be just too kooky to take seriously. And we are rude with impunity in talking about those.
But is it because they're minority opinions?
I think so. I think that's all it is. But I think this is just political. If Christianity were a small sect in the world, I think it wouldn't receive the respect. But look at all the churches that the Christians have built. Look at all the great arts. Look at all the great music. It's hard to be rude to a religion which has created so much great culture. I've had this friendly disagreement with Richard Dawkins over just this issue. And I say, Richard, I, of course, completely agree with you, but I don't think you want to hurt people's feelings. Why do you want to hurt people's... Why do you want... And for a long time, I thought he didn't have a good reply to that. And more recently, I've been thinking, man, maybe I should hurt a few more people's feelings. Maybe we should turn the tide a bit on this. Maybe we should get out in front of this. Yeah. And yes, we'll take some awful lumps because we'll be the rude, evil ones. Mm. But let's see if we can just move the barrier a little bit. But maybe we should get out there with Richard and be more be more aggressive, just to open up the space behind us. I mean, I think this is true not just in this area. I think in religion, I think that what America really needs right now is some outspoken, bold, serious liberals. Yes, they can't be elected, but let them get out there and make a big noise so that to move the center, to move the effective center.
And in, particularly in the United States, where, in fact, it is very closely tied up with Christian belief.
Certainly is.
It's true that our own Prime Minister is a very pious Christian, but I don't think one can detect, as one can in Bush and one can in the right wing of the Republican Party here, a constitutive relationship between right wing politics and born again Christianity.
Oh yes, they have the strange overconfidence of the religious zealot. They're sure that the world is what their religion says it is. There's the good guys and the bad guys, and we're the good guys, and we will smite the bad guys.
Now, granted your increasing sense of the importance of being explicit and outright and forthright about this, here you are, you've written some important, influential books on various aspects of philosophy and various aspects of science in which philosophy has interests. It's hard to imagine an area in which philosophy would have more interests than religion. What would you feel about writing a book which did, in fact, smite religion with the same energy that religion itself would like to smite people like us?
I'd love to write that book, if I could. But, of course, what one fears is what comes afterwards. And just how much disarray, how right are the people who think that we need religion to preserve whatever veneer of civilization and good feeling we have. I think religion, for many people, is sort of, you know, moral Viagra. They think some people need help being moral, and don't deny it to them. Well, if that's true, if religion does help people lead moral lives, then one should take very seriously the proposition that we're just going to eliminate it and let the devil take the hindmost. Because the hindmost may be a great many people, and we might have the chaos that these people fear. And a lot of people, many, many people, they want their life to have a meaning. And where is it going to come from?
Yes, but there must be something better than religion. But
yes, there. We certainly hope there is. What's it going to be?
I would like to end the interviews with a song called It Ain't Necessarily So, which was from Porgy and Bess. And this is a rare version by Ray Charles and Cleo Lane. I hope you enjoy it.
It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. The things that you're liable to read in the Bible ain't necessarily so. Little David was slow, but oh my. Little David was slow, but oh my. He fought big Goliath, who lay down and died. Little David was small, but oh my. Said Jonah, he lived in the well. Well, he made his home in that fish's abdomen. Yeah, Jonah, he lived in the well. Did y'all know that little Moses is found in the stream? That little Moses is found in the stream.
Yeah, he floated on water till old Pharaoh's daughter, she fished him, she said, from that stream.
Oh dear, it's that time and I've made them very upset.
Oh, and what else? Okay.
It's Animal Connection time, and I really need to read you a wonderful story that I found that was emailed to me, actually. And it was on wimp.com/fawn, F-A-W-N, rescued. It's called The Rescue. Let me read this. It's so beautiful. On the morning of May 18, 2011, my wife noticed a deer in our yard that appeared to be frantically looking for something in the rocks that form a wall on our property line in Brush Prairie, Washington. When we first went out with our neighbors, we didn't see anything, but the deer wouldn't leave our yard. We went back to our house and watched. After a few minutes, the deer came back. We went out to the area the deer was concentrating on and could hear a baby fawn crying in the rocks. We moved some of the rocks and smaller boulders and saw a baby fawn's face in the rocks. He had apparently fallen in one of the gaps and was now trapped. The larger boulders were too heavy to move, and we didn't want the rocks to cave in on the baby deer. We called our Clark County Fire District 3. The B shift team came out. They were able to move the larger rocks out of the way with the jaws of life, enough to be able to reach in and pull the baby fawn out and reunite it with its mama. The fawn maybe had been stuck all night and quickly went to nurse its mama. If you would like to see this video, go to wimp.com/fawn rescued. Now, there is a book recommendation that I would like to also give you. It's called Ghost Dogs of the South. I read this a long time ago and I noticed it, had forgotten all about it. And its stories, which is so relevant to things like talking about God or mysticism. These are stories of people whose dogs died and claim they have seen the ghosts of their animals. They're really quite interesting. And I recommend that you, the publisher was John F. Blair. I don't know. It's probably out of print. It's an old book, but you can always check. It's from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, BlairPub, BlairPub.com. And it's called Ghost Dogs of the South. Now, I would like to end with my life is bearable when? After dieting, the scale says you lost 10 pounds. And the Chinese cookie wisdom this week is skill comes from diligence, which I'm trying very hard on this radio show to get a skill. Now, I also wanted to remind you that if you have any comments, please email me at atrevida45, that's A-T-R-E-V-I-D-A 45 at verizon.net, or the studio feedback@wgxc.org, or you can tweet me at Atrevida Forever or call 518-828-0290. Let us know what you think of the show, and your comments are appreciated, good or bad. So I'd like to end this with another version of the song It Ain't Necessarily So. This time it's by Paul Robeson, and here we go.
It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. The things that your preacher is liable to teach you, it ain't necessarily so. Little David was small, but oh my. Little David was small, but oh my. He fought big Goliath, who lay low and dieth. Little David was small, but oh my. Yes, Jonah, he lived in the whale. Now he made his home in that fish's abdomen. Yes, Jonah, he lived in the whale. A little Moses was found in the stream. A little Moses was found in the stream. He floated on water till old Pharaoh's daughter, she fished him, she said, from that stream. Oh, yes. Methuselah lived 900 years. Methuselah lived 900 years. But who calls that living when no one will give in to no man what's 900 years? I'm preaching this sermon to show it ain't nessa, ain't nessa, ain't nessa, ain't nessa, ain't necessarily so.